91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Today's program begins with a visit by the longtime editor of The New Yorker, David Remnick. His duties now include hosting the recently developed New Yorker Radio Hour. The magazine was founded in 1925 and is known for its erudition, cartoons, fiction, satire, and clever covers, of course. How will those translate to an audio medium? More on that in a bit. And Linda Gassenheimer, today she explores the delights of Mexican cuisine with noted chef, author, and restaurateur Rick Bayless. He created the PBS series Mexico, One Plate at a Time. He owns the Frontero Grill in Chicago, a James Beard Award winner. Fred Tasker gives tips for wine and Mexican food. That's next, following the news.
Seven minutes after 1 o'clock. Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper.
Thank you.
Well, readers of the New Yorker magazine, two of them are sitting right here, anticipate each weekly edition for its reporting, commentary, criticism, essays, fiction, satire, cartoons, of course, and poetry, and the beautiful titled hand-drawn cover.
The New Yorker is a legacy magazine, of course, dating from 1925. It's expanded into the website, app, and social media spectrum, and in October first offered the New Yorker Radio Hour. The program airs at 2 p.m. each Saturday here on WLRN.
And with us now is the veteran editor of the New Yorker, David Remnick. He's also
hi,
the host. Hi, hi.
Veteran, I sound so old.
Venerable.
Venerable, grizzled, all that stuff.
Well, you are the host of the New Yorker Radio Hour, in addition to all your other many responsibilities. So how is the new project going?
It's fun. I have to say, it's fun. And, you know, I've been a radio nut all my life, and to take part in it rather than to be the occasional once in a blue moon guest is fantastic. I think you know very well that radio is going through a real renaissance of creativity and reach, and both on the air and in podcasting, and it's fun to be a part of it.
I couldn't imagine the New Yorker Television Hour.
No. You can now. In fact, Amazon has a New Yorker program that starts in February.
Really?
You backed that car right into the garage.
It's not just video of you, of the radio producers.
No, God forbid. No. It's a separate show in a kind of magazine, 60 minutes type format, based on New Yorker pieces and humor as well. And it's done by Alex Gibney, a documentary filmmaker that's probably one of the best in the country. And The projects are different. The television thing is very much in Alex Gibney's hands, and we kind of give advice and provide stories in a certain way, but it's a little less in our control. The radio thing is right up in the floor above me. We have a studio right in the New Yorker offices. People from the local public radio show are here to produce it, and they're great. And that's the way we do that. So our involvement in that is up to our chins.
Do you decide content on the shows, the New Yorker Radio Hour, as well as hosting?
Well, it's collaborative. Okay. In other words, there's a guy named David Krasnow from WNYC, which is the New York version of your station. And he and his team are working with me and other people at the magazine to conceive of the show, what it should be, who we should talk to, what the reported pieces should be. So it's very much a collaborative effort.
Now, the program, again, airs Saturday at 2 p.m. here on WLRN. For those listeners who haven't heard it, David, what can they expect from it?
Well, you know, on a given show, I'll usually do an interview with someone. I interviewed Amy Schumer, Gloria Steinem, founder of Black Lives Matter, Ta-Nehisi Coates, a range of people in various worlds, just like you would do you would see in the magazine a kind of New Yorker profile. But there's also humor pieces. There are the equivalent of a reporter at large piece, on maybe on politics, on sometimes it's lighter, sometimes it's more serious. It's inspired by the magazine, but it's got to be its own thing. Nobody's reading cartoons over the air. You know, that we're not. That would be incredibly lazy and not very interesting.
No. Well, now that you've interviewed so many people for mm-hmm. for the eye, how different is it interviewing people for the ear?
It's such a good question. It's so different because when I'm interviewing somebody for a written piece, I'm kind of discursive and all over the place, and I know that I have, if I'm lucky, pretty much unlimited time with that person.
Right.
And it's only later that I go back and listen to the tape or look at my notes and see what it is I'm using. And a lot of what I'm using is descriptive rather than straight quotation. Here, it's got to be a much more disciplined conversation. It's happening in real time. Even if you're taping it and editing it, it's happening in real time with two people talking in a room. So it's an entirely different craft. And I have a lot of respect for people who do it well, and I'm learning from them all the time.
But you do edit the interviews somewhat after you conduct them.
Sure. You know, you don't want to inflict the boring bits in this format anyway.
You know? You don't have that luxury.
Yeah. No, I'm going to try not to be ruthlessly boring.
Well,
I'll self-edit.
What about, because I'm thinking, you know, we're reading a tragic piece or we're reading a really serious piece or a profile in The New Yorker, mm-hmm. and there's a Roz Chast cartoon thrown in or a Ziegler cartoon thrown in.
Sure.
So we can at least get some relief from whatever we may need from reading that piece. So how do you translate that?
Well, like life, you know? If right. we had nothing but laughs, we'd fall over with a stomach ache and we'd be pretty banal. If we had nothing but tragedy, we'd all fall over for a different reason. And the great gift of The New Yorker that I didn't invent but rather inherited from the originators of The New Yorker is its capacity to shift gears tonally from one page to the next. And even on the same page, you know, if you're reading a long New Yorker piece about, say, the Middle East, there's also gag cartoons mm-hmm. speckled throughout the... And that's a formula of the New Yorker. It's kind of an unlikely one if you think about it, but we're now used to it. To do that in real time on a radio show, obviously you can't speckle that, you can't have in the middle of a long conversation about the Middle East all of a sudden somebody have a one-liner. That would be totally insane.
Exactly.
And you wouldn't want to hear a comedy routine and somebody interrupt himself or herself and suddenly break into an aria about the Middle East. But you can, you know, make the show varied. You know, it's like a meal. You don't want a meal where everything is colored orange or brown, or and everything being all sweet or all hot, it grates. It wouldn't. It's not interesting.
How about some of your more staid writers going over to radio? I've known some great newspaper writers who just hate to come on the radio and quote multitask.
You know, that's their business. If they don't want to do it, nobody's got a machine gun to their head. And Well, I want people who want to do it. And, you know, I had the same experience when the web came along. When we added a website in the beginning, I think it's not an exaggeration to say that not everybody knew what to make of it in New Yorker terms. But after a while, a lot of writers became much more eager about writing for the web as well as for the page, because it was something that you could do in a day or two. You got an immediate reaction from an audience, and that's a great element of variety when you're working on something for 3 months, 6 months, or whatever. And it's a different rhythm. It varies your creative life. With the radio and podcasting, you have a different avenue, and you're going to be reaching different people who then may come and read you.
That's what I was wondering. Have you seen a spike in subscriptions since you're doing the radio hour?
It's early for that.
Too early. Okay.
It's early for that. I mean, we're on in New York and some other markets for a few months, and thank God, you know, places like yours are joining us now, which is absolutely wonderful.
What are some of the other markets, the major markets?
Well, we're on 107 stations now. So we're doing kind of great. And of the top 10 markets in the country, I believe we're on 7 or 8 of them. So that's in a very short period of time. And as you know better than I do, people who run stations like this are a little conservative. Shifting schedules is not something they do in the blink of an eye.
Well, you have to take something off to put something new on.
Well, in our case in New York, what we replaced was a beloved show, the car show.
Oh, gosh.
Oh, yes.
But in that case, you know, one half of the team had died, and they were running reruns period of time. And so obviously nobody blamed us for that. But shifts in schedule on public radio are not something that happened every 2 seconds. So to get on 107 stations within a few months is really fabulous. And I would guess I have to owe that to the reputation of the magazine itself.
Exactly, it's the cachet of the New Yorker.
Well, I hope so. And I, you know, when it comes to that, resting on our laurels is not something I want to do. I don't want to be in the same. I don't want to be a museum curator of a reputation of a magazine from the 50s. I want the magazine to be alive and tough-minded and funny and original and innovative now. And the same. I feel the same way about the radio.
We're speaking with award-winning journalist and author and now radio host David Remnick. He's been at The New Yorker since 1998 as editor, staff writer since 1992. For those of you who've yet to listen, Saturdays at 2, it's not the magazine read aloud. Tell us how you like it if you are listening to the program and how it differs from the magazine if you're a devotee of the magazine or how it stands alone for you. 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576, or you can email radio@wlrn.org. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back with David Remnick in just a second. Stay with us.
And we're back. It's Topical Currents, Thursday edition. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. We resume our conversation with The New Yorker editor, David Remnick. We're talking about the New Yorker Radio Hour here on Public Radio with David Remnick. If you'd like to join in with a comment or a question, 1-800-743-9576 or email, that's radio@wlrn.org.
So, David, I couldn't help but I was listening, you know, to some of the, I've heard some of the episodes, and I couldn't help but notice that there was a little Ira Glass touch in your hosting. Have you noticed that?
Have others?
Have others?
You're the first to mention it, but I should be so lucky.
Okay.
I mean, Ira Glass is This American Life is pretty fantastic, and to say nothing of popular, and it helps spawn Serial. So if after 3 months we're mentioned in the same breath, and how can I argue with that?
Well, I thought it was a good thing. I was listening to the Jane Mayer thing on the Koch brothers, and that's where I heard it. But
oh, well, that show is one of the great innovative moments in contemporary radio, and Ira Glass is, something else. He really is.
Coming up this Saturday at 2 here on WLRN, the New Yorker Radio Hour. David, you have a conversation with poet Clive James. How was that?
Well, that's going to be on the air this coming weekend.
Saturday here.
That's right. And Clive James is a figure we don't have the equivalent here. He was a huge figure on television, a terrific poet, a memoirist, Australian-born, and now he is, without a question, dying. And he's had a very severe form of leukemia for a while, and he is writing about that with extraordinary clarity and grace. And I spoke to him, and he was in his home in Cambridge in England. And it was, to my mind, a very moving interview, not because of anything I did, but because he's so brutally honest. And yet, I've never interviewed anybody more good humored, funnier, in the face of the inevitable.
And changing veins, Patricia Marks, veteran writer, another
writer
with the humor about trying out a large number of sleep aids.
Like well, here's a case where there is a relationship, a direct relationship between the magazine and the piece on the radio. Patty Marks is a kind of reporting humorist. She's a hilarious writer, but most of what she does is she goes and reports weird corners of the world. And what she did, she's an insomniac. She doesn't sleep very well. And she went out into the world and ordered or tried out every sleep panacea on the market. And nothing, of course, worked. And she did a radio piece about this. And it's very different from the piece in the magazine, but no less funny.
David, you've been at The New Yorker now. How many years is it?
You said 92.
497.
No, well, he
but
started...
I'm beautifully preserved.
Well, you certainly sound very good. But I'm just wondering...
That's nice of you to say. Did you expect me to be mumbling in my soup?
No. But talk about
I think
some of...
They'd slowly usher me to the door.
No.
I think you've had enough now, Mr. Remnick.
No. Maybe, yeah, I mean, you never know where you're going to go from here. Now you're a radio host. You could have aspirations to be on the silver screen after this. But
yes, that's going to happen tomorrow. I'm George Clooney, watch out.
But I was wondering what are some of the changes you have initiated at the restaurant? Oh, my God.
We're serving crab cakes for lunch.
At the magazine in your years as editor and the things you're the proudest of.
Oh, the things we're proudest of have real range. Whether it's an investigative story like Abu Ghraib or Jane Mayer's extraordinary investigative reporting on money and politics or, you know, war correspondence, but also, you know, this is a magazine that's also helped bring to the fore some of the most extraordinary names in fiction, Zadie Smith and Juno Diaz, people like that. So there is... And believe me, it's not all on me, not even remotely, a lot to be proud of. I work with an amazing team of really tireless editors, what's changed the most, obviously, is technology has led us to be not just a weekly magazine in print, which was plenty complicated enough in the first place, but now it's a website that has 12, 15 new things published every day that have to be worthy of the New Yorker logo. And as you say, a radio show, television, and presumably we're going to start a cleaning service and restaurants around the nation.
Yes. No.
It's a good suggestion, by the way.
I don't know where that came from. I don't know.
I don't know. We're going to reopen Wolfie's.
Oh, do you remember Wolfie's?
Well, you know, since you've mentioned that I'm 327 years old, my grandfather lived in Miami Beach, and I think it's the only place he would eat out.
Cheesecake.
No. It was, I think it was the corned beef sandwich
with his
poison.
And the waitresses with the corsages.
And at the age of 106, it finally killed him.
Is that true?
105, something like that.
And he ate those 6-inch corned beef sandwiches? My.
You know, when I would come down to see him in Miami Beach, and he lived in a little place, in a big hotel, in a little place he had. He had really modest means. It was before the real boom of Miami Beach. He lives in the Casablanca, which is in the 60s, 61st.
Oh, that's still there.
Street.
It's one of the
sure
few
is.
That's there. It's 60.
I'm sure it's much more beautiful than it was in those days. It was perfectly fine. And I opened his refrigerator, and there was a can of pipe tobacco, a half a bottle of rye, and some chopped liver. And I said, we have to go out to eat. And he said, Wolfie's is the only place for me. He wasn't interested in Cuban food. That's what I was trying to steer him toward.
We have an emailer. Richard says, loved the interview in front of the live audience with Lin-Manuel Miranda, the creator of Hamilton, and interview with Sarah Koenig, creator and host of the podcast Serial. Love tone and feel. Also subscribe to New Yorker Fiction Podcast and love it. Looks like you have several podcasts. Keep up the good work. Love getting the New Yorker flavor down here in South Florida.
How nice. I think the podcast he's referring to, the show that we're doing, the New Yorker Radio Hour, is on terrestrial radio and podcasts as well. You just go on our website. But there's also podcasts called The Political Scene. There's a poetry podcast, and there's a fiction podcast as well. So that's what that your loyal listener was referring to.
Are you a native New Yorker?
I'm the fiercest kind of parochial New Yorker is somebody who was born elsewhere, and none are fiercer than those of us who were born across the river in the state of New Jersey.
Ah.
That's where I'm from. I can see my home state from my window.
Yes.
Which is about as, that's where I want to keep it for the moment.
What is this thing I read about the Sitzfleisch. Yes, the ability to
Yiddish.
Sit through or tolerate something
it's a Yiddish
boring.
Word.
Yeah, where does that come from with the New Yorker Radio Hour?
It has nothing to do with the New Yorker Radio. I think somebody once asked me how I was able to get a lot of things done, particularly writing in a short period of time, and I used the word Sitzfleisch, which means basically keeping your ass in the chair without going to the refrigerator or going online or all the million other ways we can waste time.
David, we have an idea from a listener. They want to know if you would have a New Yorker magazine cover about the New Yorker Radio Hour.
I think we don't put ads on the cover.
Just a little thing on the bottom, maybe.
I think the way to do that is to go on to newyorker.com, and you will find plenty about the radio show, and you can listen to the radio show on your computer too.
Also, in the episode coming up this Saturday at 2, Jack Ziegler talking about veteran New Yorker staff writers, talks about creating cartoons on a weekly basis. That should be really interesting because that's difficult.
We had him on before when the book came out.
Jack's an amazing cartoonist and has been around for decades. And so what happens here is every Wednesday or Thursday I have a meeting with a cartoon editor named Bob Mankoff. And he comes in with a stack of, 75, 80, what's called roughs. And they're rough drafts of cartoons that are either faxed in or sent by PDF or Pony Express, whoever they come in. And these guys, they work like hell. And to come up with original jokes and drawings, and, a lot of them send in 10, 15 roughs, and if they're lucky, one gets picked that week. It's a tough way to make a living. It's a tough way to be constantly judged by some, clown like me in Manhattan, and because there isn't anywhere else to go with cartoons. There used to be, way back when, in the days long before I was born, in Saturday Evening Post and those kind of magazines, which are long defunct, there was cartoons, and there was a real market for them. If you got one turned down, you'd go to the next place, or right. You could even go to Playboy and do the same catching your wife or husband in bed with somebody else joke. But really, cartooning, for the most part, I don't mean editorial cartoons, but the kind that we do, we accidentally cornered the market on it. I wish it were otherwise. I wish there were more places that had them.
Well, it's certainly been a pleasure speaking with you, David Rebnick. He's the editor of the New Yorker magazine. Again, for those listeners who haven't heard it, we do air that Saturday at 2 p.m., the New Yorker Radio Hour here on WLRN, and you'll get a taste of the New Yorker Radio Hour. And David Rebnick is the host.
And I also want to say he is an author, and his book, Lenin's Tomb, received the Pulitzer Prize and the George Polk Award for Excellence in Journalism.
My mother will be very happy that you mentioned that, and I am too. And thank you guys for talking with me. It was a real pleasure.
Thank you so much, and good luck with the show.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Food and Dining, up next.
Alvin Ailey American Dance Theater returns to the Arch Center for 5 performances only, February 18th to the 21st. You won't want to miss the world premiere of Awakening, choreographed by artistic director and Miami native Robert Battle, which will be performed along with other Miami premieres and classics like Revelations. Alvin Ailey's pioneering legacy of uplifting, uniting, and celebrating the human spirit lives on, and the current season has been declared a wow by the Huffington Post. Tickets on sale now for Alvin Ailey American Dance Theater at archcenter.org.
We're funded by listeners like you and by Air Como. Does your business use compressed air or vacuum? Air Como's professionals have been servicing the compressed air and vacuum requirements of businesses in South Florida for over 15 years. More information at aircomo.com.
Valentine's Day is right around the corner, and you can show that special someone in your life how much they mean to you by giving to WLRN.
Select an arrangement, make your contribution. WLRN will send your spouse or significant other that special gift along with your personal message from Field of Flowers.
And they'll be delivered in time for Valentine's Day anywhere in Miami-Dade, Broward, or Palm Beach counties.
It's a great way to take care of your loved one and help WLRN at the same time.
You can give at WLRN.org or call 866-247-9576. And thanks.
Conserve Art recently restored a damaged screen from ancient Japan. It was a birthday gift for Anne's husband, who had received it from his grandfather as a child. You can restore your treasures, too. Insurance claims are a specialty. Details at conserveart.net.
Welcome back to Thursday's Topical Currents. Of course, we have food and dining coming up. It's Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. Well, Joe, Valentine's Day is coming around the bend.
Sunday, I believe.
Yes, yes. You believe correctly. Yeah. Now, have you gotten your loved one flowers?
I've gotten more than a loved one. I have a couple of loved ones.
A couple of loved ones.
Yes.
Did you get it through WLRN?
Yes.
Yes. All right. Well, good. Because we want to tell you that
the only way to go.
That's right. We have, as you've been hearing for the last couple of days, we are, or last few days, you can support WLRN, send flowers to your loved one, either $100, $150, or $220. But the amazing thing is you get entered into this drawing to get two tickets to see Andrea Bocelli, dinner at the Hard Rock Dinner Club, and a champagne toast. That drawing, though, is being done at 7 this evening.
Oh.
So when you get your flowers through WLRN and do it soon, you'll get entered into the drawing to win those two tickets.
And the number to call, 1-866-247-9576. 866-247-WLRN. Also, it's easy at WLRN.org. Just follow the links there.
Right. So we hope you will support WLRN and get your flower arrangements through us. But if you're planning to share a homemade romantic dinner with a loved one that night, you may want to listen in now. That's if you'd attempt cooking an authentic meal of Mexican cuisine. Linda Gassenheimer is here, of course. We have yet another celebrity chef and restaurant baron. Welcome, Linda.
Well, great to be with you. And of course, bring out the hearts and the flowers this time of year. So I want to know, you know, what kinds of foods do you dream about for Valentine's Day? Oysters, prime rib, maybe chocolate.
Chocolate?
Yeah, I knew chocolate for you would be. I knew prime rib for Joe. Okay. Well, here's a new idea. How about some hot and spicy Mexican foods? Our guest is celebrity chef and restaurateur Rick Bayless, and he's known for his extraordinary restaurants and his PBS series, Mexico, One Plate at a Time. Let's welcome Rick Bayless. Hello, Rick.
Hello.
Great to have you with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, that's great. I'm really anxious to find out what we're going to be eating, Mexican style. But also, we'd love to hear from our listeners. What's your favorite Mexican food? Or do you have some questions for Rick Bayless? Give us a call. That's 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN.
Or email is radio@WLRN.org.
And of course, with us is our favorite wine guy, Fred Tasker. He's joining us by Skype. Fred gives the wine suggestions for my Dinner Minutes columns, and you can read Fred's wine column in Saturday's Miami Herald. Fred, do I need to even ask you what we're drinking today?
Well, the question is, what wine goes with spicy Mexican Valentine's Day food? We'll try to find out.
All right. Okay. Well, anxious to hear about that.
We'll see what he has up his sleeve.
Uh-huh. Okay, Rick Bayless, first of all, congratulations. You've got many restaurant successes. You brought authentic Mexican food to Chicago's Frontera Grill, and now I understand you have several other restaurants there?
We have actually three restaurants in a row on Clark Street in downtown Chicago. The first we opened up, it's almost embarrassing to say this, almost 30 years ago, Frontera Grill opened in 1987. And then a couple of years later, we opened Topolobampo. I had been living in Mexico for a long time and was really taken with the refinement of the cuisine. Now, I know when you say that to most Americans, they go, no, there's no refinement to Mexican food. But well, it's only because of the Mexican-American food that we've been weaned on here, which is just the tiniest little tip of the iceberg that is great.
Well, Rick, yes. You know, that's what I was going to ask you, because when most of us think of Mexican food, it's burritos, tacos. Is that really Mexican or not?
Well, okay, so when people talk about burritos, nachos, fajitas, most of that stuff isn't even known in Mexico at all. That was invented in the U.S. If it was in Mexico, it was a few feet into Mexico, right at the border. There are places that serve tacos, of course, in Mexico. There are taquerias, but it's not nearly as a big part of the cuisine as most people in the United States would think about it. When you go to your sort of favorite Mexican chain place and you order the Acapulco platter or whatever, you know you won't find that anywhere in Mexico. And in fact, most of the Mexican-American food, as delicious as it can be, is really based on sort of subsistence kind of cooking. I mean, it's not certainly what you would find in the central part of Mexico, where was the seat of the government, well, of the Aztec Empire before
right.
the Spaniards arrived. There were court cuisines. There was a lot of incredible refinement, and still is to this very day.
Well, I wanted to ask you, Rick, we keep talking about Mexican food. What are some of the traditional Mexican flavors?
Okay.
Educate us.
Sure. Okay, so if you're going to have a big party, you're probably going to go one of two different directions with the food. If it's a casual party, then you're going to make a huge pot of pozole. So pozole is a pork and hominy stew, if you will, that has all these fresh garnishes like shredded cabbage added to it at the very end. So if you've ever had, it's kind of funny that Mexico's our next door neighbor, but my allusions will be to Asian things. But if you've ever had like a great big bowl of pho from a Vietnamese restaurant that's long simmered stuff with a whole lot of fresh vegetables and herbs added to it, that's what pozole is really like.
So pozole it's got hominy and it's got pork, but what are the special spices? I mean, what makes it so Mexican?
There are three different versions of it. One of them is done with a very simple broth, no flavors other than perhaps some onion and garlic added to it, and then part of the toppings would be crushed chili. The second version, which is my favorite, is the one that's made with dried red chilies, usually guajillo chilies that look a little bit like New Mexico chilies or ancho chilies, and those are cooked with it the whole time, and that makes this deep resonant flavor and this deep rich red color.
Well, you're talking about chilies and all, and so the ancho chilies, what are the chilies that you use specifically for your Mexican foods, because there's so many different chilies here?
Well, if you walked into our storeroom right now, you would count about 35.
Oh, all right.
So
no,
do you want me to enumerate all of those?
No, never mind.
And they're not used. Mostly people that don't know much about chilies think of chilies as adding spice to a dish. But in Mexican cuisine, they're first and foremost thought of in terms of their flavors. Are they chocolatey? Are they bright and sort of cranberry-like? And there's everything in between. Are they smoky? Are they high in acid? There's all these different flavors. And so, the way they're treated in the Mexican kitchen integrates the heat. It's not like adding a blast of spice to a dish. In fact, that's considered really bad cooking in Mexico.
What about chocolate in Mexican cuisine?
Well, you know, Mexico is thought of as the origin of chocolate. And it was very, very highly prized during the Mayan time, about 700 and 800 AD. And then that sort of carried over into the Aztecs, 1300 to 1500. And it was so important that they actually used cacao beans, the chocolate bean, as a form of currency. And it was so highly prized that if you were to make it into a beverage, it was a little bit like drinking gold. It was only served to the upper crust.
And I understand that at that time it wasn't sweet. It wasn't a sweet flavor.
Well, there was no sweetening agents really in Mexico except from the agave, a type of agave nectar and honey. But there's really no record in those ancient texts of making chocolate sweet. So if you think about black coffee, you're pretty close to where
it
is.
Was. Well, now, you sent me a recipe, and it's up on the website, talking about chocolate, for a Mexican hot chocolate with churros. So it was such a simple recipe, and it looks so delicious. So tell us about it.
Okay, so Mexican hot chocolate is made from a special kind of chocolate. When chocolate was taken to Europe and then sugar was added, it became a kind of bonbon pretty quickly, and they wanted it to melt on your tongue. Once you get it to that place, it can have nuances of flavor, but it loses a whole lot of the fresh flavors, because to get it really to melt like that right on your tongue, it requires a whole long period of grinding. So in Mexico, they don't grind their chocolate very much at all, and that preserves a whole lot of the fresh flavors. Then that is diluted in either milk or water. And if you go to a place like Oaxaca in southern Mexico, that's sort of a chocolate capital, if you will, there's a whole street of mills that do nothing but chocolate. It smells so amazing when you walk down the street.
So
people take that chocolate home, and then they make their hot chocolate out of it. But most of them make it with water, not with milk.
Water. Well, I noticed in your recipe that you froth it up, so it looked really delicious with churros. I don't know that we can buy churros. I mean, you gave us the recipe, but maybe it would taste good with some donuts. It'd be a nice Valentine treat.
Well, it would be good with anything. It says certainly when you go in Mexico, when you have chocolate, that's what everybody thinks of as churros, which are fried dough, just like a donut is. But they're extruded. It's made from a very simple batter, but it's extruded out of, people say you could use a pastry bag to do it, but I've never been very successful with that part of it. Usually it's done with something that's analogous to a cookie gun, but on a much bigger scale.
They sell them on the streets here in Miami.
Yeah, churros are very popular everywhere. They originally come from Spain, and so every place the Spaniards went, they took the notion of churros with them.
Right, so that would be wonderful to have your churros and dip it into that chocolate. That would be a nice Valentine's treat as far as I'm concerned.
Of course.
And I understand that you're a major party giver.
I love to give parties.
Yeah, so if you're going to give a Valentine's party, what would you be serving?
Well, you know, a Valentine's party is a hard one because usually I think of something extremely intimate. So that would maybe, for me, just be a party of two. I might invite my daughter and her fiancé over, but to tell you the truth, I think they'd rather be by themselves. So I'm going to say my party's probably just going to be a party of two. And for me, what I think of as Valentine's stuff is going to all be about wonderful bites of luxury. Okay, whatever that means to anyone, that may be, in my cuisine, that may be a little bit of mole, the really classic dish. As I was going to say before, if you're going to have a party in Mexico and it's a big group of people, you'll think about pozole, the pork and hominy soup. But the other thing that is very classic is to make some mole. And I just came out with a book, my ninth cookbook of all things, that is called More Mexican Every Day. And I have the simplest mole that you could make. They're always complex because it's all about complexity.
Well,
to make mole,
and mole takes, excuse me, lots and lots of different ingredients in it, so
well, what
it
I've
takes
done
a while.
Is to, what I have done is to actually pare it back to what are the absolute essential ones and what are the essential steps, so I can actually produce this really delicious mole in about an hour. So that's what I would serve, and if I had access to a grill, I'd probably grill some quail, something that I don't do very often, and serve that mole on that quail, and because the bites of luxury would usually include something chocolatey at the end, I would think about some kind of a chocolate dessert. And I like warm chocolate desserts. I like things like a beautiful, just a single layer cake, a chocolate cake, like a devil's food cake, no icing on it at all.
Rick, you're getting right to my part of the meal, wonderful chocolate cake. But we're going to have to take a little break here. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we're talking with celebrity chef Rick Bayless. We'll take a short break, and we'll be back with more. And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we've been talking with celebrity chef Rick Bayless. He's the owner of Frontera Grill and several other restaurants, and he's a TV star on the PBS show Mexico, One Plate at a Time. And he's been giving us some tips on Valentine's food and Mexican food in general. And he's going to be here at the South Beach Food and Wine Festival on Sunday, February 28th. There's going to be a dinner at the Lowe's Beach Hotel. And that's going to be really, really interesting. More information, it's at Google South Beach Wine and Food Festival. But right now, it's dinner in minutes time. So I'm going to give you my recipe for a Valentine's dinner, simple and easy. It's grilled lobster tail with black beans and rice salad.
Wow.
So Florida red lobsters are in season, and this is a real simple dinner. You split the hard side of the lobster tail with a sharp knife, and then you can butterfly it, open it, and then you slit open the meat. So you've got a nice flat lobster tail, and then I put some sherry and some crushed garlic and butter on it, and just put it on the grill for a few minutes.
Mm.
So simple. You could even put it under your broiler. If you do under a broiler, then cover it with foil. 10 minutes and it's done. And while the lobster cooks, you can boil up some rice. And then you can add to that an oil and vinegar dressing and some onion and a little garlic cloves. And then I mix with it some canned, rinsed and drained canned black beans. Now, I use canned because this is dinner in minutes. So
15 minutes.
15-minute dinner. That complete recipe and a photo, it's at dinnerinminutes.com. And please follow me on Twitter. That's at L. Gassenheimer. Fred Tasker, what are we drinking for Valentine's Day?
Well, you know, Linda, I'm sure you take me for granted and assume I will insist on champagne for Valentine's Day. But in truth, one of my favorite Valentine meals was accompanied by Diet Coke.
Come on, Fred. I do not believe you.
We had reservations at a fancy French restaurant, but when we got there, they were overbooked and couldn't seat us. And every other fancy restaurant was booked, so we ended up having a very pleasant dinner / breakfast at a local Denny's. And I can tell you that Diet Coke goes very well with the Grand Slam breakfast of eggs, pancake, and bacon, especially at 1 a.m. on Valentine's Day.
All right, so I'm waiting for the real drink here.
Well, in truth, your stereotype of me is spot on accurate. Champagne or sparkling wine is the perfect quaff for almost any Valentine's Day meal. You can find a bubbly for anything on the menu. First, your grilled lobster would go very nicely with a sparkling wine in the category called Blanc de Blanc, which means it's made entirely with white Chardonnay grapes. Or if you have dishes with chicken, pork, veal, ham, that sort of thing, it would go nicely with a Brut bubbly, which is made of both red and white grapes. And even a big ribeye steak can go with a Blanc de Noir bubbly made entirely of red grapes, or even a powerful rosé bubbly that actually has some red wine in it. Now, Gloria Ferrer, who's a Spanish winemaker in California, makes nice wines in all of these categories in the $25 range. And for Rick's spicy dishes, you want a bubbly with a tad of sweetness. And Veuve Clicquot, the champagne people, makes a champagne called demi-sec, which technically means half dry, but in fact means half sweet. So go figure that. And then finally, I recommend you go home for a nightcap of dark chocolate with glasses of Bonfils Italian dessert wine called Rosa Regale. This is a sweet red wine that smells like roses and has a nice little champagne-like fizz. And it's very romantic, so good
honey.
That's
a fabulous wine. I love that one. That's really good. It's great with sweet things. So, Rick Bayless, what do you think about champagne with your Mexican food?
I think it's fine. A lot of people do want to have something that's effervescent to go with it. I think we're all sort of, we grow up in the United States thinking about something bubbly like a beer to go with Mexican food. When you get into something that's more like a mole, like I was talking about, Something, a sparkling wine would be fine with it, but it really, really, really resonates beautifully with, like our Grenache from Southern Rhone. It's deep, rich flavors in the wine, and the slight earthiness go really well with the dark red chilies that are used to thicken that mole. And when you get into the complex side of Mexican food, it tends to skew more toward red wine than white wine. It's certainly because the cuisine is sort of earthy and complex, sweetness would tend to be kind of out of place with that. The sweetness will really stand out separate from that. If you're looking for something that is, you know, a lot of times when you eat Asian food and it's got this blasting heat in it, that's not part of Mexican food. So a lot of people want that sweet to kind of calm it down, but you rarely find that in Mexican food. So usually I think of New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc would be kind of a go-to for me with all of its fruitiness for a white, and then sort of the Southern Rhone reds. For if I was to sort of say one place in the earth that I would turn to look for wine that would go with a greater number of dishes in my cuisine.
Wow.
Rick, do you ever use any Mexican wines?
Tons. We have a huge Mexican section on our list. It's very, very sparely available in the United States. Not very many people have it, but, you know, there's a major wine-growing region in Mexico. There's just so much demand for the wines there that they're not motivated to sell them outside of Mexico. They can sell them all in Mexico. But the Valle de Guadalupe in the northern part of Baja California is just an amazing wine-growing region. People are surprised to learn that there's over 125 wineries just in that one valley.
Right. So, fantastic. Rick, we only have about a minute left, and I just wanted to ask, we mentioned briefly that you're going to be at the South Beach Wine and Food Festival.
Yes.
And just shortly, can you tell us what you'll be serving there?
Well, I'm going to be doing a demo, and I'm actually going to teach people how to make a fresh cheese, and then this really, really delicious vegetable mix that you find as a simple entree, but it's a great taco filling. So that's my demo, and then I'm doing a book signing after that. And then at that Los Hotel, I'm doing a full dinner, and it's going to be... I'm not replicating Like Water for Chocolate, the movie, though that will be screened that night, but I'm doing my own inspirations from that movie, and it'll be very luxurious bites.
Well, it
sounds
wonderful.
Really nice.
That sounds terrific. Yeah. Well, it's been a really tasty week. Thank you so much, Rick Bayless, for joining us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Great. And that recipe for the chocolate is at dinnerinminutes.com. Fred Tasker, thanks for your great advice.
Always a pleasure.
And happy Valentine's Day to you.
Same to you.
And I hope the snow goes okay there in Michigan.
Oh, we're loving it. Pretty.
It's 9 degrees there.
Lucky Fred.
Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, great talking with you.
You'd be my Valentine, Linda.
With pleasure. Next week, we're going to be having a hamburger competition between Pincho Factory's Nadal Ahmed and the Federal's Cesar Zapata. That'll be really interesting. Well, I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me then.
And that wraps up today's program. What about Valentine's Day, Bonnie?
Well, it's Sunday.
Yeah.
I mean,
and glad to lead you on this way.
Yes, and you can get your flowers. Choose from 3 arrangements, either at the $100 level, the $150 level, or the $220 level. And you can get them through WLRN at 866-247-9576, 866-247-9576, or online. You can see them and pick them up there, WLRN.org.
And apologies to the callers we couldn't get to. Our New Yorker segment was produced by Polly Landis with additional assistance from lead producer Richard Ives, technical direction by online producer Paul Leary. As always, we have free audio archives for download at our website. That's WLRN.org. Follow radio, then Topical Currents. Also, more information, links, and photos at the Topical Currents Facebook page.
flowers, 866-247-9576 or WLRN.org.
But there's more, Joe, because two lucky people are going to see Andrea Bocelli at the Hard Rock Live, and we're having that drawing tonight at 7. So get your flowers.
I forgot. Tomorrow at 1, it's NPR Science Friday. Bonnie and I return for President's Day with a program which looks at the history behind presidential assassinations, woundings, and attempts. Florida Atlantic University professor Ronald Feynman. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned. Here and Now is next from NPR News.